Pseudopod, episode 139, April 24th, 2009. This week's story, Old Ways, by Dan Dworkin.
This week's Pseudopod is brought to you by Audible. Go to audiblepodcast.com/pseudopod and claim your free audiobook.
Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm Alistair, your host, and this week's story comes from Dan Dworkin, who recently appeared here with the excellent The Valknut. Dan has been a professional television writer for 6 years, and has worked on Dragnet, the short-lived SF series Surface, and Cold Case. He's currently a co-executive producer on the excellent Criminal Minds, a series which any fan of the more grounded style of horror we sometimes do here really should check out. Everyone else should give it a try for Penelope Garcia, the team's IT tech, who is A, awesome, and B, a pretty solid and remarkably accurate fictional version of my illustrious and epically cool other half. Your narrator this week is Jenna Sharp, a professional voiceover artist who is available for work through the Voices.com site. That is also home, by the way, to the excellent Ian Stewart, who recently read Graves of Ships for us. If you need a voiceover artist to knock it out of the park, drop either of them a line. Her website address is in the blog post, and Ian's is in the one for Graves of Ships. So, prepare yourself for the realization that sometimes the old ways are all we have. Because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
Old Ways by Dan Dworkin. The man in the doorway was backlit by the low-hanging sun, and when he told her about Ray, it didn't seem real.
Dead?
Yes, ma'am, I'm afraid so. Fatima gripped the front of her blouse and twisted. She steadied herself against the door jamb, and when she spoke, it was a whisper.
Imkonsis.
The detective frowned as he was not learned in Uzbek. I'm sorry?
I say, it's impossible.
Everything about her was fragile and too thin. Her wrists, her neck, even the skin on her face, which was translucent in the morning light.
I wish you were right about that, ma'am.
She pressed her lips together and breathed through her nose, drawing the outside air, crisp with ozone and tinged with the recent fires. The detective cleared his throat. His car went off Sunset Cliffs. That area can be pretty treacherous, and with the rain last night.
Fatima shut her eyes and held her breath.
When she spoke, it was sort of a croak, and she was not yet ready to let it go.
I must see him.
I wouldn't recommend it, ma'am. He's not... The detective cleared his throat again. There was an explosion when it hit. In the distance, thunder rumbled, and Fatima looked to the horizon where it was dark. Do storms ever end, or do they just move from place to place?
Is there anything I can do for you right now, ma'am?
Fatima turned and faced the inside of the home she and Ray had begun. It was clean, immaculate. How Ray liked it. She would have been a good wife. She hugged herself and whispered, and her accent was pronounced.
Mama!
The detective stood awkwardly in the doorway and watched her. Maybe there's someone I can call? When after a few moments she did not answer, the detective looked at his feet and cleared his throat, then closed the front door and went on his way. Georgiana Kastryulin arrived an hour later, and only then did Fatima cry. It was how she'd entered the world, weeping at her mother's feet, and no subsequent trauma would be complete without her. Georgiana was short and thick, with arms like mortadella pistons, and a mole on her eyelid that showed when she blinked. Through the strands of thin grey hair that fell to her shoulders, one could just glimpse dark green Cyrillic lettering on the back of her neck. She was 54 years old and strong from within. She cradled her daughter on the couch and let her moan. The sound was pathetic and distant, emanating from a region so deep within Fatima as to sound disembodied.
Ray!
She cried with moments of silence, as if waiting for a reply.
Ray!
Georgiana stroked her hair and whispered in her ear, and pressed her forehead hard up against the side of her neck. It had been years since she'd held her daughter in such a way, yet her protective bearing had not waned. There was a fierceness to her maternity that had always been part of her.
"I know this pain, Fatty, but you must be strong for him."
"What will I do?"
"He would want you to be strong."
Fatima turned to her mother now, and her eyes were clear.
"There is no strength without him, Mama."
They remained like that in silence for several minutes. Fatima let herself be rocked gently by her mother, her breath measured and deep and rattling. Then her breath stopped with the onset of the idea and the question.
"What of the Jodhuga?"
Georgiana went still, halting the gentle rocking motion, and blinked several times.
"What did you say?"
"I know what is possible. If there is someone..."
"No."
Georgiana stood and distanced herself from Fatima.
"Fatima, whatever you think you know..."
"I know where you went in Itkim, after Papa was killed. I saw..."
"You don't know. You were a little girl."
"I was old enough to listen and follow you."
"Fatima."
"To the cemetery with that man."
"Stop."
Georgiana paced and wrung her old hands together, in no way prepared for the turn the conversation had taken.
"Even if it were possible, we are not in Itkim anymore."
"But Itkim is in us, no? Us and the others who left and came here. That is what you've always said. Or was that a lie also? You know them here, and those you don't know you can find. They are Roma. Some must know the old ways."
Georgiana quickly retook her seat so their knees touched and she could look Fatima in the eye. She stroked her hair insistently, as if to wipe these new thoughts from her mind.
"Even if there were such a person here, you would not want this. What happens to a body in death?"
"I don't care what he looks like."
"They say he was burned so badly he was not able to be recognized."
"I don't care."
Fatima's voice cracked as she looked at her mother, and her eyes were a child's.
"I have to say goodbye, Mama."
Georgiana continued to stroke her hair.
"You will see him again one day. He waits for you."
Fatima looked down, taking some solace from this.
"He waits?" "Yes. One day you will be together again."
Georgiana stroked Fatima's hair and thought it was over. Had she seen the sun rising in Fatima's eyes, she would have known different. They buried Ray on a Friday in the rain. Fatima sat in the front row with Georgiana, who held her hand throughout the service in a tight grip that never faltered. In her other hand, Fatima held a cheap grey umbrella with the words "Hemmings Bank" stenciled upon the handle in an unsightly puce. It was one of several such umbrellas at the funeral, as many of Ray's co-workers were in attendance, and the umbrella had been a company Christmas present. Ray had been a derivatives trader. Fatima knew only that it was a good job, and that he was usually able to come home by 4 o'clock because of the timings of the overseas markets, which was nice for them. She planned to find out more about his job when they were married. During the service, a co-worker of Ray's that Fatima had never met talked about how Ray had been generous and warm, and how this had made him stand apart from the other people who did what he did. The man was short, with a shaved head and a New England accent. He seemed at ease speaking in front of people. He told a story about how Ray had recently befriended a homeless man outside their offices, how he had bought the man lunch and struck up a friendship and saw him as a real person and not some animal, and how others at the office had made fun of him for it, but that Ray didn't care. Fatima knew nothing about Ray's homeless friend, and she told herself it didn't matter. During the speech, people turned to look at her, but she stared past them to the horizon where it was clear. At the cemetery it continued to rain. The storm had come back for Ray. Fatima vowed to go with it when it left this time. By the time the casket was lowered into the ground, the pile of earth beside the grave had turned to mud, and Fatima had made the decision to die. Georgiana was dreaming when the hospital called, and at first she didn't understand. She still dreamt in Uzbek, and to hear English upon waking made for a difficult bit of processing, even now, 20 years after she and Fatima arrived in America. On this night, they were old dreams, images of Eitkim she'd long since laid to rest in her mind, of her husband Nikolai's death. They were dreams she'd had for many years after leaving. On this night, they haunted her anew. Mercifully, the ringing phone cut it short. She woke with a start, and in the moment before the phone next rang, she could hear the voices of three drunken men singing in the next apartment. Her neighbour Zorak and the others would often drink vodka until very late, perhaps to keep their own dreams at bay. On any given night, the building would boom with the wet baritones of drunken emigres. Georgiana picked up the phone and sat up in bed, and the person from the hospital told her what Fatima had done. When she got to her hospital room, Fatima was sleeping and out of danger. Georgiana sat down next to her bed and watched her breathe, and went a full minute without blinking. She feared losing sight of her. The doctors said she would be fine. They had to put a tube down her throat and wash her stomach with charcoal, and there was an IV leading into her arm to replace lost fluids. She would be discharged later that day. Everything would be okay, they'd said. When Fatima woke, she was slow to place herself, and in her face there was confusion and fear. Her expression changed with a resurgence of memory, and a grave disappointment took root. She'd realized her failure. She was still alive. Georgiana reached out to touch her face, and Fatima turned her head. Georgiana swallowed and blinked, and turned to the paper cup on the nightstand.
They said you might be thirsty.
Fatima turned back and let her mother press the cup to her lips. She choked on the first sips, and the water dribbled down her chin. Georgiana took a tissue and wiped around her mouth.
When you were a girl, I would clean your face like this. I always knew when you would sneak on your shoulder, it would be all over your lips.
Georgiana smiled with her mouth, but her eyes did not change their cautious appraisal.
You remember?
Fatima just nodded, silent. Georgiana brushed the bangs out of her face and looked into her eyes.
Why would you do this, Fatima? Why, my little one?
He's waiting for me. I must go to him.
No.
It's like you said.
Fatima.
Georgiana's was the frustration of one talking to a toddler. She straightened in her chair and patted down the sheets around Fatima, tucking things in properly, neatening.
You will stay with me. You will be nice, like when we first came here. We watched the TV, all the stations, 100 stations. We can watch the people from my balcony walking by on the street, and we'll cook me shoulder and curt.
Mama, don't make me.
Of course, Fatty, we don't have to do those things. There are other things.
Fatima gripped her mother's hand, and it was desperate.
Mama, don't make me live without him.
Georgiana sat silent, then pulled her hand away.
To live is not a choice, Fatima. It is what we do. We go on. It is my choice.
And at that moment, Georgiana knew that this was true. Fatima's eyes were clear, and there was no self-pity, no sadness, no real thought at all. Just truth. And she knew that there was only one thing she could say to convince her daughter that her life should continue. She looked down at her hands and closed her eyes and breathed the words, "Perhaps the Jodigar." Fatima looked up at her, and her eyes were wet. She reached her hand out to her mother, and Georgiana let it hang there for a moment before taking her hand and pressing it to her face. The pact was made. The moment was interrupted by a knock behind them. Georgiana turned to see a man in a dark suit standing at the threshold of the room, at a respectful distance. He produced a thin leather flap from his pocket and opened it to reveal a shiny brass badge and nodded his head towards the older woman with respect. "Hello, ma'am. I was hoping to ask Fatima a few questions if she's up to it."
"Is it a crime what she has done? To take pills?"
"No, nothing like that. It's about Raymond." Fatima recognized the man's voice, less so his face, backlit as it had been the day in the doorway. But the voice she recognized, and it was kind. "It's okay, Mama." Georgiana leaned down and kissed her forehead, and left her lips there for what, to the detective, was an uncomfortable amount of time.
"I have to go see someone. I will be back for you."
And then she left. The detective nodded to Georgiana as she passed and approached Fatima's bedside.
"How are you feeling?"
"Better now." "Why did you come about Ray?"
"Well, I feel strange bringing this up, what with the circumstances, but..."
He removed a pad from his pocket and referenced some notes.
"Some people at your husband's work have come forward with some irregularities."
I don't understand, please."
"Did you ever have any indication that Ray might be having issues with money?"
"Money? He was a hard worker. He made good money. I don't understand."
"I have to admit I don't fully understand it myself, but apparently Raymond was making trades under a false client account that he'd set up."
"False client?"
"Yeah, see, looks like he was using the bank's money to invest in a portfolio that no one actually created, and he lost a lot of the bank's money that way, close to a few million dollars, according to the folks at Hemmings."
"A few million?"
"So far."
She looked up at him in disbelief. "They've got the bean counters over there working overtime. Say they might not have a final tally for a few days."
"You're saying he stole?" "No, I don't believe this."
"More likely he was borrowing the money with the intention of paying it back when his investments hit, but when he started losing."
The detective could see that Fatima was having trouble understanding, and he closed his pad and slowed down.
"Look, nothing's official, but I figured I'd take the opportunity to clear anything up on your end."
"I know nothing. Ray was an honest man."
The detective nodded and smiled without showing his teeth. Georgiana returned to her apartment building and knocked on Zorak's door, and when he answered, she asked for vodka. He had a moustache and was fat in the way that healthy men were fat in Eatkim. Strong fat, and loud.
"Ah, all these years you said you do not drink. I know you were lying."
"Today I drink."
He knew then that this was not a social visit, and waved her in. Zorak was slightly younger than Georgiana, in his 50s, and he'd done well in America. He had come with his wife and they'd had a child here. He had a small plumbing business, and he drove around town in a white van and serviced the units in the building as well. He bought two small cylindrical glasses out of the freezer with the vodka and poured them each a few ounces. He put the bottle on the coffee table between them and handed her one glass. They raised their glasses, and though etiquette demanded eye contact, Georgiana looked down. She set the empty glass on the table in front of her, and Zorak refilled it. But she left it there and sat back on the couch, and only now lifted her eyes.
"The Jodigar."
Zorak paused at this, then drank his second drink and refilled the glass and held it in his hand.
"First the vodka, now the Jodigar.
It was an attempt at humour that died in the air between them. He is here, she said.
I have heard, yes. And you know how I can see him?
Zorak hesitated, as this was no simple request.
You have met him before?
Georgiana's eyes were dark as she remembered.
Yes. I know someone.
Zorak looked at her like one would a wounded animal, circling without getting too close.
You are sure?
Georgiana drank her second drink and refilled the glass herself. She drank that one too. And when she set the empty glass on the table between them, it was all the answer Zorak would get. He placed a call and spoke softly in Uzbek, then hung up. 6 minutes later, the phone rang again, and he picked it up and listened and wrote down an address on the back of a receipt from a hardware store. Georgiana took the address and set out across town to find the man who resided there. It had been many years, and it prompted the old images in her mind. She recalled the season of fear in Itkim that had precipitated their exile. Her local politician had run on a platform of closing down Roma housing settlements and ridding the city of the gypsy problem. He'd won in a landslide, but when it came to implement the agenda, it met with great resistance. When the local police started burning the homes, her husband Nikolai had stood firm. He was shot dead by local police, and their house was burned to the ground as Georgiana and a 6-year-old Fatima stood by, helpless to act. There were many funerals that followed, but the dead were not buried under the ground in Itkim. Instead, there were crypts above ground. It made things easier for the Jodigar. Georgiana met him in his high-rise condominium at the base of the hills, where he lived as a shut-in amongst tenants who had no idea what he was. He was 81 years old. A woman would bring him groceries every fifth day, and he rolled around on his wheelchair on a laminate floor and tended to a garden on the small balcony. He hadn't touched the ground at sea level in 3 years, not during the day in 5. Tattooed Cyrillic letters reached up from his chest, through the front of his shirt collar and onto his neck. He was roomy-eyed and would clear his throat of phlegm several times a minute. Georgiana told him her story and asked for his help, and when he responded, his speech was slow and trailed off at the end of his sentences.
I am old now. What you ask?
I am old too, Georgiana pled. But we are strong, our people. Made strong by what we have lived.
The man smiled, but there was no joy in it. Only unfortunate assent.
Fatima doesn't have that strength. Her need for love makes her weak.
That is what love does, yes?
A father's love. Nikolai died when she was 6.
Yes, I remember.
He darkened at the mention.
I remember also the danger in calling him to rise.
This is different.
One who dies of violence may rise as violence. The spirit has rage.
Nikolai died at the hands of another. This man, Ray, it was an accident. It is safe.
The man sighed and shook his head, and Georgiana sensed he would not be so easily compelled.
She misses something inside her.
Georgiana looked down at her hands in her lap.
I cannot bring it to her, but Raymond, her husband, he was the only one.
You believe your Fatima will choose death without this?
She already has.
The man rolled his wheelchair to the window and lifted back a corner of the blanket that covered it. He squinted as he looked over the city.
The skyline had grown around him since he moved here years ago. He shared the dreams of Georgiana, the dark dreams of Itkim, but there was a part of him that yearned for the old ways. There are things one does to feel alive in the interests of being true.
We will go tonight.
That night, Georgiana returned to the hospital to pick up Fatima, who walked slowly as she made her way to the waiting room. She held her head steady with one hand, and a few times she had to stop and settle the nausea in her stomach. She spat often in an attempt to rid herself of the charcoal taste in her mouth. When Georgiana got her to the car, she told her what was to come that evening. Fatima hugged her tight, and Georgiana knew that she could be trusted not to end her life. She dropped Fatima off at home and drove towards the cemetery. Georgiana met the Jodagar and two of his nephews at the cemetery and led them to Raymond's plot. His nephews were stout and bearded, and one of them carried a large duffel bag which clinked with metallic contents every few steps. They spoke in hushed tones and never addressed her directly, and they never smiled. The older man took laboured steps with the aid of a cane, and the nephews walked on either side of him in a protective formation. Georgiana knew that they would protect him with their lives. In Itkim, to be a sentinel of the Jodagar was to be the envy of those who sought honour in their lives. Much had changed since the flight from their homeland, but the sacred never changed. Their judicious steps over and around, but never across the individual graves, bespoke a great respect for what lay beneath them, and for the power it held. When they arrived at Raymond's plot, the one nephew unclasped the duffel bag and pulled out two shovels. He handed one to his brother and kept one for himself. The old man touched the headstone and ran his hand over the inscription there. His touch was delicate and deferential. It was almost as if he was seeking permission for what he was about to do.
"This will take time," he said to Georgiana. 4 hours. You will go to your daughter and come back with her then."
Georgiana stared at the grave and tamped down second thoughts. She nodded to the man and left the sight, and did not look back. Behind her, the nephews positioned themselves at either end of Raymond's plot. Then they began to dig. At home, Fatima had been struggling with her wardrobe for the past 2 hours. Ray liked her in flowers. After much deliberation, she decided on a loose-fitting blouse and toeless shoes with a lavender floral buckle. She put her hair in the style that Ray liked best, up with a red ribbon. Ray didn't like makeup, but tonight she cheated. She needed it. There were rings under her eyes. She looked at herself in the mirror, and she thought it wasn't good enough. Not for Ray. As she started to undress, the doorbell rang. Fatima looked at the clock. It was a little past midnight. Her mother wasn't supposed to be picking her up to take her to the grave until 1 a.m. Maybe she'd come early in the hopes of talking her out of it. Fatima set her jaw and strode towards the door with purpose, determined not to be swayed by any last-minute appeals. She would go to the grave and see Ray, in whatever form he took. She did not care. She had to say goodbye. Her mother would not change her mind. She swung open the door, expecting to see Georgiana. But it was not her who greeted Fatima. It was Ray. Fatima was stunned into silence and immobility. Her mouth moved, but no words emerged. He was just as she remembered him, baby-faced and doughy, with a receding hairline and one earlobe slightly longer than the rest. He would pull on it during moments of stress. Sometimes Fatima would pull on it for him, preemptively, when she knew he was feeling anxious. He had small eyes and small teeth, and his smile made her forget where she was when he said, "Hi, baby." Fatima rushed towards him and threw her arms around his neck and slammed her face into his chest with a force that almost knocked him over.
Oh, Ray! Ray, is it you?
It's me, honey.
Is it really?
Really, truly. I guess I have some explaining to do.
No, it is me. They brought you back because of me.
What do you mean?
You are here because of my people, the Jodigar.
Listen, baby, I'm here because we have to go. My death, I mean, obviously, it's a fake.
Fake?
Yeah. Baby, look, I got in a little over my head, and, well, they were going to come after me sooner or later, so I... Listen, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter?
All that matters is that we're together again, but we have to go.
Go where?
Out of the country. Canada first, then maybe Europe. I don't know.
You made this up? You were... It wasn't you in that car? In the coffin?
No, it wasn't me.
Then who?
It's not important, baby. Fatima stepped back from him and began to tremble.
Who was it we buried?
At the cemetery, Raymond's grave had been exhumed. The plot was unearthed and the coffin within was open. The moonlight revealed its present emptiness. Around the perimeter of the plot lay three bodies, one that of an old man. There was a cane nearby, and his head was twisted at an unnatural angle. There were two overweight bearded men within 50 yards, one face down and the other on his side, both unmoving and also twisted at unnatural angles. Somewhere in the night, not far away, a former homeless man, who'd been equally dead up until very recently, walked the streets with a shuffling gait. His skin was charred black and falling off in places, and he was consumed by a rage he did not, or could not, understand.
Revenants fascinate me. They are both a wonderful and deeply horrible concept, and I'm pleased to see they're undergoing something of a renaissance. As well as Dan's sterling work here, the concept has surfaced in differing forms in comics more than once over the last few years. TV, the current season of Ghost Whisperer springs to mind, and yes, I watch Ghost Whisperer, and yes, I'm comfortable with that, and Mike Carey's excellent Felix Caster novels. Then, of course, there's the industry standard, James O'Barr's seminal The Crow, which is both arguably the definitive take on the story and, I would contend, one of the finest and, at times, most difficult to read graphic novels of the last 25 years. But, definitive as O'Barr's story may be, the modern Revenant, and there's a name for a newspaper if ever I heard one, is a more varied, more rounded individual. The tortured, rain-slicked murder victim, gun in one hand, guitar in the other, still has his place, but he's been joined by revenants who live amongst us, hold down jobs, who have options. Of course, they're still concerned with meeting out horrific bloody vengeance, but, you know, variety is the spice of unlife as well.
Flash Forward and Robert J. Sawyer are going to be terms you hear more and more over the next few months. Mr. Sawyer is a particularly good science fiction novelist, and Flash Forward is one of his novels, the TV adaptation of which is already being touted as one of next season's big guns. The idea is simple. On May 21st, 2009, yes, really, the Large Hadron Collider is turned on. The moment it is, every single person on the planet finds their consciousness projected 20 years into the future for 2 minutes. Some are dead, some are alive, and some are doing the last thing they'd expect to be. The twist is this, though. The present-day world does not stop when these consciousnesses are transported, as everyone who is driving a car at the start of the flash-forward finds out. Needless to say, it gets messy. The TV show, by early accounts, changes the format a little, so the jump is 5 months ahead and features Joseph Fiennes, younger brother of Ralph and Ranulph, as the lead, with John Cho, who will shortly be seen as Hikaru Sulu in Star Trek, as his partner. They are playing FBI agents, by the way. It looks, for all the world, like a class act, like classic big idea science fiction, with a format which, speaking as a structural gonk, really entertains me. And if it's even halfway faithful to the book, then it's going to be very, very good fun. Sawyer writes old-school science fiction in new clothes, never feeling dated, but always tying each big idea to a character. The exploration of the effect the flash-forward has is intelligently and compassionately played, and the world feels real, feels normal, making the event all the more extraordinary. It's just one of Audible's 40,000 books, and if you sign up now, you can choose it for free. Go to audiblepodcast.com/pseudopod and claim your free audiobook.
Pseudopod relies on you to pay our authors, our hosting costs, and to power our secret HQ buried far, far beneath that spooky old mansion on the edge of town. So, if you like this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise you won't regret it. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. And Pseudopod would like you to know, you're next.